We had planned to have Bruno lead us in a song in Swahili this morning, but Bruno's boss yesterday told him he had to work today and next Sunday, and he tried to get out of it but was not able to do it. So I apologize to all of us for that. I would have loved to have sung. You know, I thought about trying to lead Mokozi Wetu myself, but decided not to try that this week. But we've been really blessed these last 6 weeks to have a good bit of singing in Swahili, and we will do more of that. And we'll look forward to more singing in other languages. A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing. Martin Luther wrote those words in German, and he also wrote the music, the tune that we sang this morning in 1527, 28, 29, in that time frame. And it very quickly spread, became a theme song of the Reformation. It was a time of great danger there in the late 1520s. It seemed as if the forces arrayed against the Reformation could succeed in putting to death the leaders. And what would happen to the cause if Luther were to be killed, if all the other major leaders were dead? Would all that they had worked for and fought for since the nailing of the 95 Theses to the door of the church in Wittenberg, would all of that be in vain? Well, Luther's partner, another leader of the Reformation, Philip Melanchthon, expressed these concerns to Luther in a letter that he wrote in 1530, just a couple of years after Luther had composed A Mighty Fortress. Here's Luther's response, dated June 27th, 1530. And he here clearly reflects the themes of Psalm 46, which he put into A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. He also displays a lot of his own personality in this letter. With all my heart, I hate those cares by which you state that you are consumed. They rule your heart by reason of the greatness of your unbelief. If our cause is false, let us recant. But if it is true, why should we make him a liar who has given us such great promises and who commands us to be confident and undismayed? What good do you expect to accomplish by these vain worries of yours? What can the devil do more than slay us? Yes, what? I pray for you very earnestly, and I am deeply pained that you keep on sucking up cares like a leech and thus rendering my prayers vain. Christ knows whether it comes from stupidity or the Spirit, but I, for my part, am not very much troubled about our cause. God, who is able to raise the dead, is also able to uphold his cause when it is falling, or to raise it up again when it has fallen, or to move it forward when it is standing. If we are not worthy instruments to accomplish his purpose, he will find others. If we are not strengthened by his promises, where in all the world are the people to whom these promises apply? But more of this at another time. After all, my writing this to you is like pouring water into the sea. Thus, Martin Luther. We here in the United States today are not usually worried about being killed for the gospel. Nevertheless, life often does seem as if it is out of control, as it did for Philip Melanchthon. It can seem as if random chance is harming those around us and taking aim at us. Or even worse, as if the enemies of the gospel and as if Satan himself are advancing their cause, becoming increasingly powerful, and are going to overwhelm the faithful church of God. And the church herself can seem weak, divided, with false teachers flourishing and faithful teachers failing. Well, Psalm 46 is written for times like 1530 and for times like 2018. We don't know the historical occasion that led to the composition of this psalm. Some have speculated that it was written after the Assyrian king Sennacherib surrounded Jerusalem in the time of King Hezekiah, and it looked as if the whole kingdom was going to be destroyed. And remember what happened? Recorded in 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, and Isaiah in three different places. Remember? As they slept, God killed 185,000 of the Assyrian soldiers. And so the people of Jerusalem looked out, and they just saw the camp empty. All their enemies were dead. Another possibility for the historical setting of this psalm is what we read from 2 Chronicles chapter 20, the great victory of Jehoshaphat, which was really just God's victory because Jehoshaphat didn't do anything except for pray and put the singers in front of the army, and then they looked out on the dead bodies of their enemies and plundered them for 3 days. So whether the historical occasion was one of those events or another, the kingdom had seemed to be in grave danger from a powerful military force. So powerful that there seemed to be no hope of repelling it. And God delivered his people. So if you take a look at the psalm on your device or in your Bible, there are three stanzas, very clearly stand out, verses 1 to 3, verses 4 to 7, and then verses 8 to 11. And notice that the second stanza and the third stanza ends with the same sentence. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. So we're going to look at this psalm under three headings. We're going to consider the first two stanzas together and pick out two different themes from those stanzas. And then the third heading, we'll look at the third stanza. First of all, is everything falling apart? So that'll be verses 1 to 7, part 1. And then second heading, God secures his people, verses 1 to 7, part 2. And then finally, so relax, I'm exalting my name, verses 8 to 11. So first of all, is everything falling apart? In 1530, Philip Melanchthon certainly thought that. He was worried that everything was falling apart, and we often have similar feelings. The psalmist pictures those feelings. In verse 2, he speaks of the earth giving way and mountains being moved into the sea. Indeed, the waters roar, the waters foam, and the mountains are fearful, they're trembling. To understand these expressions, it's helpful to remind ourselves of the creation account from Genesis 1. Remember, before God begins his acts of creation, darkness is over the face of the deep. There's just water everywhere, and it seems to be chaotic water, right? The water is unorganized, undivided, overwhelming everything. And then God speaks. And on the third day, he says this, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And so the dry land separates from the waters. So you see what the psalmist is saying in Psalm 46? Back on the third day of creation, God separated the waters from the land. And the mountains are the picture of the highest, the most secure land, never affected by the waters. Right? Lowlands might flood. The mountains aren't going to flood. But here, it seems like the earth is giving way. And the mountains are being moved into the heart of the sea. Again, not just even onto the beach, right? Or not even just into shallow waters, but into the very heart of the sea. So it's a reversal of creation. We see that. The former separation is now being overwhelmed, and the mountains are being thrown into the heart of the sea, being moved into the heart of the sea. So the natural order, creation itself, seems to be falling apart. But it's not only the natural order, it's also the political order. Look at verse 6. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. Well, you can't see this in English, but that word translated totter, that Hebrew word translated totter, is the same word about used in verse 2. The mountains are moved into the heart of the sea. So you could translate that, the mountains are tottered into the heart of the sea, but that doesn't sound very good in English. So the kingdoms, which can seem stable and secure and firm, they too are being overwhelmed. So we have natural creation, political power, all these things seem to be overthrown. All of them are being shaken and are falling apart. Now, what about in your own experience? When have you felt as if things are falling apart? What has seemed most stable to you, which has ended up proving insecure? As if you're standing on a platform and suddenly, what seems solid underneath you disappears and you sink and you're flailing. And you don't know how you can get out of it. It can be marriages, it can be friendships, it can be jobs, finances, health. When such things fall apart, when what you depended on fall apart, what's your natural inclination? Well, your natural inclination is the same as the natural inclination of the psalmist, and that is to fear. He makes a statement in verse 2, "We will not fear." But the very statement, "we will not fear," implies that he's tempted to fear, right? He says, "we will not fear," because when it seems that all is falling apart, that's our first response. So we, like the psalmist, can face a world that seems chaotic. We face a world where what we used to depend on no longer secures us. We face a world in which it can seem that no one is in control, that danger is all around us, and that we're powerless to do anything to stop the chaos. Well, how then does the psalmist address these feelings? Second heading, God secures his people. In the creation account, God imposes order on the chaotic world covered with water. In Psalm 46, God does something similar. He shows his people that while all around them may appear to be chaotic, he still rules, he still governs, he still secures his people. In the first two stanzas, verses 1 to 7, we see three ways that God secures his people at this time. Three ways that he continues to secure his people today. So the first way that God secures his people, and the main point of the entire psalm, he is with us. He is our refuge. As a refuge, he shields us from danger. We are in danger. We run to the refuge. We're protected from the danger. He is our strength. as our strength, when we are weak, when we are unable to accomplish the task, when we're unable to defend ourselves, we run to him, we seek his strength, we tap into his strength. He empowers us in weakness. And then the psalmist says, not only is he a help to us, not only is he an ally to us, but he is a present help. He is a present ally. And not only that, he is a very present ally. An ally doesn't do you very good if he's 1,000 miles away, right? It might be nice to know he's on your side, but he's not going to be able to help you very much. But when that ally is right next to you, and he's all-powerful and almighty, then you're in good shape. He's a very present help. He never leaves us or forsakes us. And then verse 7, as we said, repeated as a refrain at the end of the third stanza also, the Lord of hosts is with us. The Lord of armies is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. So with him we are secure. He's a fortress. No enemy can scale those walls. No danger can assault the fortress and get to those that he protects. Well, verses 4 and following expand on this image in an interesting and I think a surprising way. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. So picture a flourishing, vibrant city surrounded by impenetrable walls. That's the idea. Okay, well, what's the problem with a city if it has great walls so that no enemy can overcome the walls? What's the danger? The danger is not having a water supply. But this city has a river flowing right through its center, and so it's providing what is necessary from outside so that the people inside are fully secure. So God's people are in this secure city. So God is pictured both as the fortress, the walls surrounding the city, the impenetrable walls, and God is pictured as in the city with his people. It is his habitation. He is in the midst of the city. And so he is encouraging the people. He is loving his people. He is in intimate relationship with the people, even while he is protection for the people. Now, of course, the psalmist surely had Jerusalem in mind as this city. And a number of other psalms speak of Jerusalem, of Zion, as the city of God, including Psalm 48, which we're going to look at next Sunday. And we'll see a little later this morning how the New Testament picks up on this image of God's people as his city. But the main point of the psalm is God is with us. God is in the midst of us. He protects us. He never leaves us or forsakes us. He is always with his people. So we are safe and secure. But the second way that the psalmist helps us to overcome this temptation to fear is that he stabilizes us. Remember verse 2 again, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea. And verse 6, though the kingdoms totter, same Hebrew verb as we said. But in verse 5, we read, God is in the midst of her, God is in the midst of the city, she shall not be moved. Same Hebrew verb again. So notice the contrast then. The whole created order might seem to be moved, shaken, sliding into the sea. The whole created work may seem to be undone. The political kingdoms may seem to be undermined. They might be moved and destroyed. But even if all that happens, God's city, God's people will not be moved. They are stable. They are secure because God stabilizes his people. He secures his people. His people do not slip. They do not fall. They do not stumble because he is with them. But then thirdly, the third way that the psalmist helps us to fight against fear is that God controls all these dangerous forces. What looks chaotic, what looks threatening, is under the control of God himself. Look at verse 6. This is perhaps my favorite verse in this entire psalm. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. In the midst of chaos and political upheaval, in the midst of war and intrigue and betrayal and scheming, God speaks just as he spoke on those 6 days of creation. God speaks and all else falls before him. It doesn't matter how powerful the forces are. God is in control of all of them. He doesn't organize his people into an army to fight the enemy, though he could. He doesn't send lightning and wind and hail to destroy the enemy, though he could. But instead, he speaks. And at that voice, all is accomplished. His words all by themselves are mighty and powerful. So you see, though all around you may seem to be out of control, though all may seem to be falling apart, God is in control. Things are never out of his control. He only has to speak, and that chaos, that opposition is over and done with completely. The good Swahili word, kabisa, over and done with, kabisa. No more, nothing else to happen. So if the chaos continues, if the enemy seems to thrive, it is only by his permission. And he is accomplishing something through that temporary success of his opponents. And thus Luther writes, "The prince of darkness grim, we tremble not for him. His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. One little word shall fell him." But with those three ideas fresh in our mind, that he is with us, that he stabilizes us, that he controls all the dangerous forces around us, return to the idea of God's people as a city. And let's look at the way the New Testament authors pick up on this idea, particularly in Hebrews and in Revelation. We read from Hebrews chapter 11 that Abraham went out, left his home city, left what was stable and known to him. He went out not knowing where he was going. Why? Because he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. He was looking forward to God's final city, where God's people are all together in God's presence. That same passage in Hebrews says that God's people here in this world are strangers, exiles, refugees seeking a homeland. And God has indeed prepared for them, for us, a city. Revelation 21 then pictures this city. Beginning in verse 2, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. God is in the midst of her. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God, and he will wipe every tear from their eyes. And death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. So you see, the psalm pictures the present day when God's people are his city. He is the fortress, the walls around them, and he is in the midst of them. They are safe and secure. Though chaos reigns outside of them, God is in control even of that chaos. And then Hebrews and Revelation picture the new heavens and the new earth. Again, where God's people are a city, but now God has spoken that word. He has felled that prince of darkness, grim, and his enemies are no more. And he is with us forever and ever. And in that new city, we no longer need his protection from those forces because they are over and done with. The old order has passed away. He has wiped every tear from our eyes. And so we are to remember both of those pictures of God's people as a city. Today, we are protected. He's with us. He surrounds us. And in eternity, he will rid creation of all that is opposed to him. And we will see him face to face and dwell in that impenetrable light. Well, third heading. So relax. I am exalting my name. Let's read this last stanza, verses 8 to 11. Come, behold the works of the Lord. How he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes war cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Three commands I want to highlight from this last stanza. First of all, look, behold. In 2 Chronicles 20, we hear a similar command. Right? Remember when the prophet Jehaziel then spoke after Jehoshaphat's prayer? Jehaziel tells the king and the people, verse 17 of 2 Chronicles 20, you will not need to fight in this battle. Stand firm, hold your position, and see, behold. See the salvation of the Lord on your behalf, O Judah and Jerusalem. Do not be afraid. Do not be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, and the Lord will be with you. That was the prophecy. And then what happens? Verse 24, when Judah came to the watchtower of the wilderness, they looked toward the horde, and behold, look, see, there were dead bodies lying on the ground. None had escaped. Look on the devastations that God has wrought. Look at his victory over the forces of those who oppose him. And so that is what the psalmist says in Psalm 46. Behold the works of the Lord. Now, he's not talking about the wonders of his creation, the stars, the heavens. He's saying how he has brought desolations or devastations on the earth. Look at how God has overcome his enemies, even to date, as a foreshadowing of that final victory over all of his opponents that is yet to come. I think in the historical context of the psalm is very much that idea from 2 Chronicles 20. Okay, you're out, you're praising God, you're singing to him as the army advances, you get to this high place, you look onto the field, and that whole army opposing to you is already gone, it's already dead. Look on the devastations that he has wrought. Look at the exercise of his power. Today, we too need to look. And what do we see when we open our eyes, when we look? How do we see what God has wrought? We see something much greater than God's victory over 185,000 Assyrians or over this huge, numberless horde that was attacking in Jehoshaphat's day. Think of the passage that we read from Luke chapter 10. After Jesus sends out the 72, they go out in the power of Jesus. They see him at work, and even the demons obey them, and they're very excited. And Jesus says, "Behold, look, I have given you authority to tread on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy. And nothing shall hurt you. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Look then at the power Jesus has given his church and is implementing through his church. Don't close your eyes to it. You will not read about this in the newspapers. But there are many, many reports available of what God is doing around the world now to expand his kingdom. And we can see God overcoming the power of the enemy. Jesus goes on in Luke 10 to say, "Blessed are the eyes to see what you see." Again, you're seeing something greater than 185,000 dead bodies. I tell you that many prophets and kings desired to see what you see and did not see it. So look, behold. We're privileged to see what God's people have longed to see for centuries, for thousands of years. We see God using people like you and me to reach all nations. We see God sending out a young couple who met in this church to Turkey, and they're there now, and they're learning the language. And what might God do amongst them for the Kurmanji Kurds? We see peoples who have walked in darkness for thousands and thousands of years, and on them a great light has shined. And we see a plentiful harvest. And so we pray for more workers for that harvest here in Charlotte and around the world. So look, look, look. Look at China. You've heard me say these statistics before, that when the communists took over China, there were about 1 million believers in China, and they killed about a third of them. And about a third of them recanted and said they didn't believe in Jesus anymore. And the other third were thrown into prison, some for decades and decades. And those in prison spoke of Jesus. And throughout the time of the great leap forward in the cultural revolution, God was working through these faithful saints. And so by 1980, the church was 50 times larger than it was in 1949-50. Look at what God has done. In the midst of horrible opposition, in the midst of persecution, God is in control of all of these forces. So pay attention. Look, his kingdom must come. His will must be done on earth as it is in heaven. He's bringing it about, and the evidence is all around us. Look. That's the first command. Second command, recognize. Verse 10, the ESV reads, be still and know that I am God. NET, be still, recognize. Recognize that I am God. And I like the connotations of that word. So having looked, draw the right conclusions from what you see. I think that's the idea. Look and recognize, know that I am really in control, that I am the Almighty God. Recognize who I am and what I am doing. Recognize my sovereign power. Recognize that I am indeed the Almighty One. Recognize that nothing can resist me. One little word shall fail them. Recognize that I am working for your good, even when it doesn't seem like it. So look, recognize, final command. Relax. Relax. Verse 10. Be still. That's the way it's translated in the ESV. There's a question here, an interpretive question here. When he says, be still, is God speaking to his opponents who are warring? That's the way some translations render it. So, Holman Christian, stop your fighting. Or is he speaking to his people? My people, be still. Know that I am God. My people, relax. Recognize that I am God. I think it's the latter. I think that's what the psalmist is saying. Be still, my people. Relax, my people. Recognize that I am God. Don't be worried. Don't be fearful. He's saying, I am with you. I love you. I am your fortress. I am in control of all of these forces that are arrayed against you. All may appear to be falling apart, but one word of mine will order the chaos, will defeat the enemy. For I am doing a great work, he says. My name must be hallowed. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in all the earth. I must bring those from every tribe and tongue and nation to myself. And everything that happens is part of that great plan of mine. It's part of that great tapestry that I am weaving together, that I will complete on that last day when Jesus returns. You may not see how it's working together, just as if you turn the tapestry around, it looks like a mess. But when you turn it and see how all the different threads work together to this object, to make this object of great beauty, then you see, okay, that's not chaos. That's purposeful. So relax, says God. Trust me. I am for you. I am with you. And in the midst of what looks like it's all out of control, I am glorifying my name and accomplishing my purposes. Look, recognize, relax. So what is falling apart around you? What seems chaotic? What seems out of control? Whatever your darkest hour might be, it's not a darker hour than what Jesus experienced at the crucifixion. It's not darker than the night when Jesus was betrayed by a close friend, when he was brought before a show trial, when he was abused and whipped and mocked and nailed to a cross and bled and died. And for the disciples, who had just forgotten what Jesus said about him being killed and rising on the third day, that was the moment when all of their hopes were dashed, when they were most confused. And yet what happens? God utters his voice and Christ conquers death. He rises from the dead. He sits at the right hand of the Father. He reigns in power. He will return in glory. And so, look, behold, God was sovereign even at that darkest hour in the history of the world. Even at the crucifixion, God was in control. And so, recognize, God is in control in your darkest hour. And he is exalting his name among the nations. He's exalting his name in all the earth. So be among his people. Be part of that city which God is in the midst of. Recognize that Jesus does have all authority in heaven and on earth. And so submit to him as your Lord and Savior. See him as your treasure. Turn to him and be saved, and then, God's people, relax. Trust him. Yes, fight the fight. Fight the good fight to believe. Yes, make every effort to add to your faith virtue and to virtue knowledge and on up that ladder in 2 Peter 1. It's not relax, sit back, and lay back on the beach and wait for the Jesus to return. But don't be fearful. Don't worry. God's in control. He is with you when you belong to Jesus. And he will see to it that all that happened is working together for his glory and for your good. He secures his people, and he will fulfill his purposes. A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never, ever failing. Let's pray together.